You're listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. We'll go right straight to Frank in Phoenix for the Metal Report. Good evening, Frank.
Good evening, Bill. Boy, we've been in for a wild ride lately, haven't we?
Yeah, I had the phone lines hooked up here, and that's why, I mean, not hooked up, but screwed up here, and that's why you couldn't get on. That's why I was late getting on the satellite. And that's why people order this tape. It's not going to start right at the beginning. And that's why that other little bit of music just jumped in there. I've been chasing my tail here for the last 5 minutes. I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, the good thing is you sound a whole lot better.
Oh, I am. Thank you.
Good. I'm glad. But in the metals, in the last couple of weeks, we've had a lot of people, your listeners and watching, have jumped up dramatically. And they seem to be holding at this stage of the game. We've seen some rather erratic movement on the Dow. But what we got to do, just as when it takes big jumps to the upside, we shouldn't get all excited about that. When it takes big dumps to the downside, we should be cautious but not real excited about that either.
Well, I'm pretty excited about gold breaking 400.
Well,
to me, that's a watermark.
Well, yes, it is. It really is. And they were able to beat it back. It broke 400, but they were able to beat it back down to just... So it closed at just under 400. The technical analysis is that the barrier for gold is 410. The technical people on Wall Street and the rest of it say if gold breaks 410, then it's running.
Now, wait a minute. These are the same guys that when gold was at 380 said if it broke 400, then it's running.
Well, like I said.
Same guys.
Well, what do you want from Neil Cavuto? I mean, come on, these guys on CNBC and the rest of it, they don't know what's going on. I mean, they don't know anything about what's happening. What we got to look at, though, is not only the price of gold and what the Dow's doing, but some underlying factors here. We got some very interesting underlying factors. Brokerage stocks. Okay, the people in the know, yeah, they're going to be brokerage houses, right? What have they been doing? Laying off brokers, not by the hundreds, but by the thousands. They've been laying off brokers. And brokerage stocks are taking a major hit. As a group, they've been hit very hard. The other thing is even though the Dow appears to be holding or doing well, some people think, oh, it's no big deal, minor correction. Over one-third of the New York Stock Exchange, over one-third of the stocks are struggling. 36% of them are struggling. There's some serious problems. There's some very serious underlying problems. One very interesting thing, from a newsletter, someone who does who analyzes the Dow Jones Industrials and all that other stuff, he wanted to see where everything stood. Everybody thinks October, because October 29 and October 87. It says more bear markets, more problems occurred in January than in October. So that's something to think about. He's calling for, with the general market being sloppy here at year end, and with the transports being weak at the end of 1995, it would not shock me to see trouble entering the picture during January 1996. But once again, Bill, I think you might end up calling it on the head. There's an interesting article in the newspaper today discussing the market, the paper market. Trading heats up after final bell. So people, they think they can breathe a sigh of relief by the end of the day with all the markets are closed. I'll worry about it in the morning. No. Closing bell no longer signals end of trading. But the roots of the error provide novice investors with a close-up look at the nebulous world that is after-hours stock trading. Bill, you say it all the time. No conspiracy. It's in the open.
Yeah, it is.
It's in the open everywhere you look. I mean, you know, I follow that philosophy. I read a horrendous amount of material, and you pick up these little tidbits, and that's exactly what they're doing.
The skill is knowing how to identify important information and correlate it with other important information.
Exactly. That is the hardest thing in any intelligence gathering. You can get all the data. People think going out there and snooping and pooping is the hard part. That's the easy part. So the guy that gets all the stuff that you snooped and pooped and got, you know, that's got to do something with it to come up with a picture. That's a tough thing. I think we may have the picture. Have you seen the 1994 United Nations Human Development Report?
Yes.
Okay.
Why don't you sort of condense it?
Yes. Basically, collapsed economies to start fresh so everybody has work.
That's right.
They make some very unbelievable statements. Quotes, lifestyles of the rich nations will clearly have to change. Major restructuring of world's income distribution, production, consumption may be necessary precondition for a viable strategy for sustainable human development. and this is my favorite. One thing is clear. Preserving productive capacity intact does not mean leaving the world in every detail as we found it. These people are telling us exactly what they're going to do, and it's not going to be pretty. So if people think it's going to get better, it's not. It's going to get worse. If people think they're going to wait for the election to do this or do that, it has nothing to do with it. It's completely immaterial. The bottom line is the game plan is to make everybody so stressed out and have to go to them for work. That's the only way they can control people.
Yes, except for those of us who are going to be self-sufficient and ready and willing to not take part.
Exactly. For those of us that aren't worried about, oh my God, but I'll have capital gains and or this or that, get it done. Because the reality is if you don't, you might as well throw it all away now. Because they're going to kick it out from under everybody. They're just going to kick the legs on the chair out, and everybody's going to have to start from square one.
I can't wait to start hearing all these pseudo-intellectuals who are teaching and promoting Marxism. I can't wait to see their reaction when they find out they're going to be the first ones to get the axe when all this happens.
It'll be rather, unbelieving. They'll probably complain a little bit and just go into denial. But, yeah, traditionally they always are the first ones that go to the pit.
Yeah, you see, it's because it's not really a United Nations takeover. The United Nations, for all intents and purposes, is the United States of America.
Exactly.
The United States Police Force, the United Nations Police Force, is the military forces of the United States of America.
People need to be looking past all of this, okay? You've got so many people focusing, the John Birch Society, they focus on UN, UN, UN. How much you want to bet in a couple of years, there will be no UN.
That's right.
Okay, fine. You want us out of the UN? We're out of the UN. Why do you think we're not paying our bill? IRS, they're going to be gone too. What do you think Steve Forbes is all about? Push that whole issue. IRS will be history as well. You want to get rid of the IRS? Fine, we'll get rid of the IRS. People need to stop focusing on these single issues, and they need to look at the broader picture. And yeah, it will be under the United States. That's the way it's all fixing itself up to be.
That's the way it was all set up. That was the plan. That's the secret destiny of America. It's written in all the occult writings. It hasn't been hidden. I've broadcast it. I've told the people of the world on this broadcast. I've tried to wake them up. I've tried to get them out of these silly little cul-de-sacs they're spinning around in that they think they're really going to prevail against all this might and wealth and everything. It's only one way to prevail.
That's prepare.
That's prepare and be ready and willing to die for what you believe in.
And, well, I got George Patton said it best. He makes some other poor bastard die for what he believes in.
Well, that's right. But but I've never seen anyone in my life who was willing to step on a battlefield and do battle who wasn't willing to die for what they were fighting for.
Well, you have to be.
So if you're not ready and willing to do that, you're not going to make some other poor son of a anything die for his country or for his beliefs or anything else because you're not going to be there.
Well, you're right. You're 100% right. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people that don't follow. They think it's just going to be easy. They talk a real good game, but they don't think anything through. I mean, I got out there a little early today because I wanted the sun starting to stay up a little longer. I was out there in the mountain parts with my rucksack. I get all kinds of goofy looks. But that's okay, because
yeah.
There's only one way to get ready for marching with a ruck, and that's to march with a ruck.
Yeah.
And, I really feel it's close, Bill. I can't believe, with Clinton going away, I'm concerned about that. I don't like the fact of the weather back east. They got the guard called out in a lot of places already. Food's already off the store shelves. They're catching, a lot of people are getting caught short by this.
Yeah.
And it would be, there's too much opportunity at this stage of the game for something to happen.
Well, the biggest indicator that I've seen in a long, long time, is up until recently, we've never seen this before. When they begin to fortify the housing areas of military installations in this country, when there's no threat to those people, that's an indicator to me that they're expecting somebody to attack those housing areas. And I have no idea who it would be.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we were discussing it earlier this evening. A couple of my compadres were over in various National Guard facilities, just hypothetical discussions, and we do know that they've been taking the bolts out of the rifles and locking them in a separate area, a separate facility.
Yes, we've got those reports, too, and they've never done that before.
No, this has been for a couple of years now. As a matter of fact, they've been doing that. So, yeah, they are fully expecting something big. Of course, you know, we know that they're going to be the initiators of it, and it will spill over into their facilities. Of that, there's no doubt. But it will be ugly. It'll be guerrilla war. You're right. Government will not collapse. It's not going to. It can't. It will not. They want to have that whole democratic change. They want to brainwash people into voting away, giving away their rights one last time to the New World Order.
Yeah.
And they'll just make it so difficult and so stressful that people will gladly do that if they're not ready.
That's true. You got any specials for our listeners out there?
No, no real specials.
How about a newsletter?
The new newsletter has been out for a little bit. I've been pushing that thing out. It's a transcript of Stephen Jacobson's Mind Wars tapes. You have played his broadcast in the past. As you've done it, it's excellent, as you've pointed out. We've been trying to get the new newsletters out. If anyone hasn't gotten it from the person that they've been dealing with at Swiss America, give them a call. Ask for the new newsletter. It makes it nice to read that stuff because Jacobs, the tapes are great, but when you can have it there in front of you to share with other people, it's outstanding. But the new newsletter is a very good one. We're working on some other things. I've got that 94 Human Development Report coming to me. Oh, by the way, Chris, thank you for forwarding me those copies. I did receive it, and I've got to get the full thing. I want to do a white paper on it, break that thing apart, do a synopsis of it to be able to, for people to know what they're discussing and what they're planning. And I hope to have that done in the next month or so.
Great.
All right, then.
Okay.
Well, Bill, thank you. I'm glad
thank you.
Better.
And thank you for sitting in while I was gone, my friend.
Not a problem, sir.
I really appreciate it. In fact, they liked you so much, several people sent me faxes and thought I'd kicked you off the air. So I had to remind them that this was my program.
It's your show. we reserve absolutely zero editorial comments. Your program, 100%.
You're always welcome here.
All right, Bill. Well, thanks for having me on board this evening, and we'll talk to you later.
We are welcome, and we'll see you for sure next Thursday.
All righty.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, what I'm going to do tonight is going to blow you away, I think. But first, Continental Army of the Republic, the Second Continental Army of the Republic, is looking for a lot of good men, leaders. Leaders. If you're a leader who has military experience and good organizational skills, you don't have to know everything as long as you know how to find out who knows it and bring them and utilize their knowledge, or where to find the information that you need to relay to others. You must be responsible. Our leaders are never found on programs like Donahue. They're never castigated by idiots like Ted Koppel. In fact, most of our people are never heard from or never known of, but I guarantee you, if liberty is thrown completely and totally into the bucket, and the people of this country are attacked, you will not only see and hear from, but you will know our people. And in future years, you will probably have statues of some of our people in your town squares. Their egos are not involved. They are real Americans. They care about this country. They are dedicated and will sacrifice and do whatever is required legally within the law. We will not accept racists, bigots, religious fanatics, self-proclaimed prophets, convicted felons, or anyone else that could bring disgrace upon our military organization. We are not a paramilitary group. We are a military group formed legally and lawfully as the unorganized militia of the United States of America. If you feel that you fit the bill, if you are a person that we are looking for, send me a letter and a complete resume with an address and a phone number where you can be contacted. Your letter will be reviewed. They will be screened by me. And the ones that I feel are the best of the lot will be forwarded to the command staff, and you will be contacted. If you feel that you want to be a part of the Army that may be the Army that saves freedom and liberty for all people in this country, and if we save it for this country, we save it for the world, send your letter to the Intelligence Service, Post Office Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. That's the Intelligence Service, P.O. Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. Ladies and gentlemen, our investigation into the Oklahoma City bombing is staggering in its productivity. And everything that we have brought forward, we have brought forward first. We are holding back an awful lot of material that we cannot bring forward at the present time. Everything that we brought forward first has been confirmed by others to be absolutely 100% correct, true. Everything has been verified by third parties, second parties, fourth parties, and fifth parties. Nothing that we consider to be evidence is anything that cannot be documented. Everything that we have is documented. Testimony of eyewitnesses, it's on tape, photographs, written affidavits, you name it. A lot of it's on videotape. I ask the commanding officer of the Oklahoma Station, Major Michelle Marie Moore, to write a book on the investigation. She didn't want to at first. And resisted mightily, I must tell you. And finally, I issued her a direct order to write that book. And she is in the process of doing it. It's about half finished. And tonight I'm going to read you some of that book. In fact, I may continue with it for several days. It's going to be either a very thick book or two volumes. I can assure you of that based upon what has already been written on the information that we have already collected, both by our Oklahoma people and by all of our people, and information that we have collected, analyzed, and relayed from the Intelligence Service headquarters. So, pay close attention, ladies and gentlemen, and then you'll get some idea of the quality of the personnel and of the work that we do in the Intelligence Service of the Second Continental Army of the Republic. Thank you. Chapter 1, Reflections. Human blood is heavy. The man that has shed it cannot run away. Those words, at first they had been nothing more than a quietly passing thought, the barely discernible voicing of an ancient proverb. Initially, they had served as the dismal acceptance of the overwhelming events of that day, an acknowledgement of the evil which had come upon us. But now the day was over, long over. Hours before, midnight had come and gone, a chill had settled, and the air was unnaturally damp and oppressive. The sticky heat of the afternoon had been swept away by a sharp, bone-chilling northern blast which rushed through the city shortly before sunset, bringing unwanted rain and high winds. Threatening clouds hung low and thick in the southwest, and distant lightning warned of continued gloom into the next day. The whole world seemed to shudder that night, but how could you avoid it? After all, human blood is heavy. That night should have been the first vibrant blush of wild prairie spring. Oklahoma April. It should have been a time both tranquil and fragrant, with the scent of newly blooming iris and daffodils, a peaceful hour which should have carried the fragile perfume of honeysuckle and the prevailing southern breeze. It should have been a night for throwing open the windows after the bundling of winter and drifting sleepily into the late hours on thoughts of starlight and beauty. But you see, human blood is heavy. It had been 18 hours since the Alfred P. Mura Federal Building in Oklahoma City had exploded in an instant of carefully orchestrated horror and terror. Already, it was evident that deceptions, deliberately and meticulously rehearsed, were being given their first performance for an unsuspecting, shocked, and numbed audience. Already, a multitude of contradictions had been revealed, altered, denied, and disguised. Already a quickly manufactured blanket of disinformation had been thrown over the disaster by players who did not even realize they were performing in the drama. And from some inner place of spiritual strength and personal conviction, I knew that this situation could not be allowed to stand unchallenged. Human blood is heavy. The man that has shed it cannot run away. Those words. Throughout the day, those words had increased in intensity and fervor in my mind, and just then, in that cold, rainy darkness between days, I was hearing them at full force and volume. No longer were they merely the miserable acquiescence of helplessness in the face of so great a trauma and disaster. No longer were they the impotent sigh of hope against hope that someday someone might solve the mystery of who was responsible for these multiple acts of wanton murder. No longer was I content to remain silent and motionless while my homeland became the sacrificial altar and my countrymen the hapless victims in a highly ritualized political execution. Those words had become my force of will. There was no contemplative silence that night. For many hours, the atmosphere of my home had been a confused jumble of sounds. Television, local radio, police scanner reports, and shortwave broadcasts were all transmitting simultaneously the news of the same event. Every available audio cassette deck was in use. Every boombox was recording a different local radio station, isolated in a closed bedroom or closet. The video recorder was rolling tape, preserving information from different visual news sources. The fax machine was in operation. The computer word processor was never far from my fingertips. And always there was the ringing telephone, even into that late and desperate hour. At that moment, exhausted and shivering in the unseasonable coldness, belching back yet another cup of coffee, I knew that the possibility of sleep was out of the question. I was not so much sleepy as I was emotionally drained. My husband and I continued working throughout the night and into the next day. planning for an uncertain future, and collecting the initial information which later would assist in the separation of truth from the official story. So much vital and revealing information was broadcast during the first 36 hours after the explosions, information that might consist of nothing more than a passing glance at a significant piece of the rubble of the building, a full-face shot which identified an individual walking before the camera who should not have been there, or an unintentionally telling remark made by a witness or an expert. Important audio information was recorded from reports made by eyewitnesses to the scene, much of which would later be vigorously denied by federal officials. Some of that information would vanish completely after the first day, never again to be repeated over the airwaves. In later stages of the investigation, some of the witnesses and journalists who broadcast those reports denied ever making the statements which were recorded in their own voices. But all of these minute details would have to wait for another day of sorting and careful thought. The important thing at that particular moment was to stay totally focused on the collection of information of local origination. It required intense concentration due to the large number of sources being recorded simultaneously. But more importantly, it required basic consciousness, and my eyes were burning with fatigue. I poured another cup of coffee, cut the bitterness with a generous dollop of milk, stretched long and hard in the hope of forcing wakefulness into my bones, and returned to the living room to monitor the course of events. The need to inwardly focus and grieve was not to be given its rein at this time. The intense desire to shut out the noise and withdraw into my own private haven of safety and security could not be indulged. Human blood is heavy, and its weight is a call to service. As a member of the intelligence service of the militia of the Second Continental Army of the Republic, I had a clearly defined duty to perform, the importance of which could not be underestimated. I was sworn upon my sacred oath to gather by any and all legal and lawful means information from all sources, to provide for the free flow of information to the whole of the people, the militia of the several states of the Union. This was my responsibility, and I would perform it to the best of my ability, to my last dying breath. While tracking the videotapes, flipping the audio cassettes, and monitoring the police scanner with my husband, I reviewed in my mind the fearsome facts of that first day, April the 19th, 1995. I first heard about the explosions which destroyed the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building while drinking my morning coffee. A friend had telephoned to make certain that my husband was not working in downtown Oklahoma City that morning. I assured him that my husband was right there in the house and asked why he was so concerned. It was then that he told me what had happened. Finding himself unable to adequately describe what had occurred or to answer the barrage of questions I asked about the situation, he finally, with exasperation, told me to turn on the television for full coverage of the disaster. He said it was the only way I was going to understand. His tone was utterly serious, and he was uncharacteristically speechless about the details of the event. That was enough in itself to make me fretful and alarmed. He encouraged us to pray. Before the telephone receiver ever left my hand, I called frantically to my husband to quickly turn on the television so we could see what was going on. Rushing into the living room to see for myself what had occurred, I stopped dead in my tracks at the scene before me. One glance was enough to send me bounding back to my desk to telephone a report to my commanding officer, William Cooper. I knew it was still terribly early in Arizona, where he lived, 2 hours earlier than it was in Oklahoma, but this was a situation of such magnitude and with so many potentially dangerous consequences that I didn't think I should wait until a more reasonable hour to break the news. I was both shaking and sweating as I dialed the number. As I telephoned, my husband continued monitoring the news reports on the television. The telephone in Arizona rang only twice, and Mr. Cooper's wife, Annie, answered the phone. I identified myself, asked for Bill, and told her the call was an emergency. In the background, I could hear her urgently rousing him from sleep. Bill took the receiver, and at first sounded a bit groggy with slumber, but the instant he knew what had happened, he was fully alert, giving his undivided attention to the matter. I again identified myself, apologized for calling so early in the morning, but told him I thought he should know what had occurred here. Much like the friend who had first notified me, I suddenly found myself incapable of fully describing the event. I glanced once more at the pictures on the television. How could this information be conveyed? My mind was going into a shocked verbal shutdown, and after a moment of struggling to find any words at all, I blurted out, "Bill, somebody just blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City. The building looks like the whole front of it has been sliced off, and a big chunk was cut out of it. A lot of people have been injured, and probably many are dead. Just go turn on your TV. Get something on the satellite feed. The coverage is live everywhere." I'm sure I sounded a bit hysterical. I was a bit hysterical. There had been multiple explosions. The video reports of the disaster showed extreme asymmetrical damage. The front of the building had been blown outwardly away from the structural remains, and at the far east end, a large rounded section of the interior architecture, which had collapsed vertically upon itself, was now nothing more than a confused pile of rubble, dust, debris, and blood, 2 stories high. At first, there were 2 columns of smoke, one coming from the building and another larger column of black smoke boiling upward from the parking lot on the north side of Northwest 5th Street, where many automobiles were burning. Several eyewitnesses would later report seeing a mushroom cloud of smoke rising from the building. There was not yet any information about the number of dead or injured, only the frightened and shocked speculations offered by the news media. Firefighters were already on the scene, extinguishing the burning cars and initiating the rescue operation. The streets were filling with the dazed and bloodied walking wounded, staggering out of the rubble of federal building and the wreckage of other damaged buildings in the area. Friends and relatives of government and civilian workers in the Murrah building came running from their offices nearby. Some were crying hysterically, searching for their loved ones. Others rushed into the dangerously unstable remains of the building and began extracting the wounded from the shattered concrete and twisted metal. Mothers, weeping and screaming for their children buried inside the federal building daycare center, were clawing at law enforcement officers who held them back from the dangerous wreckage. medical personnel began pouring into the area, and many unnamed civilian heroes joined with the medical, police, and fire rescue workers to save as many of those still living as was humanly possible. The scene on television was graphically tragic and violent, dreadful and compelling. It was very painful to watch, yet it was impossible to look away. All of this information was streaming into my living room as I made my sketchy report to Mr. Cooper. At that moment, there was nothing conclusive which could be relayed other than that the Alfred P. Mura Federal Building in Oklahoma City was quite simply gone. The Alfred P. Mura Federal Building, located at 200 Northwest 5th Street, was originally called the GSA Building and was later named for a circuit court judge of distinguished reputation. Alfred Paul Mura had been born in Johnston County, Oklahoma, on October 27, 1904, the son of George Washington and Nora Simmons Mura. Alfred received his LLB from the University of Oklahoma in 1927. He became a member of the Oklahoma Bar in 1928 and married Agnes Millam on June 29, 1930. Together, they had three children, Ann, Paul, and Sue. During the 1930s, Alfred Mura was active in Democratic Party politics and helped coordinate the Young Democrats organization. With his school buddies, Luther Bohannon and Roy Savage, known together as the Rover Boys, Mura helped engineer the triumphal 1936 United States Senate campaign of Joshua Bryan Lee, Mura's former speech professor at the University of Oklahoma. From 1937 to 1940, Mura served as a U.S. District Court judge and in 1940 became a judge for the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, 10th Judicial Circuit, where he served for many years. Later as chief judge, Mura earned his LLD from Oklahoma City University in 1954. In 1947, as one of a three-judge panel ruling on an appeals case, Mura helped open the doors of Oklahoma University to black students when he ordered that George W. McLaurin, whose law school application had been denied solely on the basis of race, be allowed to attend classes at the Oklahoma University College of Law. Always active in civil rights cases, Mura found himself again working with his longtime school friend, Luther Bohannon, who had become a federal judge in his own right. When the school busing issue came before the courts, it was Judge Bohannon's ruling which changed Oklahoma City public schools from the neighborhood concept and brought about the policy of busing students to achieve integration and racial balance, a decision which remained controversial for decades. Alfred P. Mura, a Methodist, served as a trustee for Southern Methodist University in Texas, and in 1954 received the Distinguished Service Citation from Oklahoma City University and the Hethum W. Summers Award. In his later years, Mura served as the executive director of the administration office of the Federal Judicial Center in Oklahoma City. Alfred Paul Mura was a member of the American Bar Association, the Oklahoma Bar Association, the Order of the Coif, Lambda Chi, Phi Alpha Delta, and was a 32nd degree Freemason of the Southern Jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite. Mura passed away in 1975 and is buried in the northwest corner of the Fairlawn Cemetery, located at 2700 North Chartel in Oklahoma City. The building, which was to eventually bear Mura's name, had been designed under the direction of James Loftus and had been a joint architectural venture between two firms, Shaw Associates and Locke, Wright, and Foster. The structural engineer was Ed Kirkpatrick. The building was designed in the late 1960s and early 70s, and the groundbreaking ceremony had occurred in 1974. The construction had taken 18 months to complete. The Mura building was built at a cost of $13.2 million, and construction was completed in March of 1977. The building was dedicated in October 1977. Within the Alfred P. Mura Federal Building were the offices for the following government agencies and departments. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the Defense Department Investigative Service Field Office, the Department of the Army Oklahoma City Recruiting Company Headquarters, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Federal Employees Credit Union, the General Accounting Office, the General Services Administration, the Social Security Administration, the United States Air Force, the United States Customs Service, the United States Department of Agriculture, the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development, the United States Department Lab, the United States Department of the Treasury Secret Service, the United States Government Department of Transportation Federal Highway Administration, the United States Government Office of Health and Human Services, the United States Government Office of Personnel Management, the United States Labor Department, Bureau of Apprenticeship and Training, the United States Marine Corps Recruiting Station and Officer Selection Office, the United States Small Business Administration, the Veterans Administration, the offices of several federal judges, and Americans Kids Daycare Center. Although the Mira Federal Building was described by the media as a 9-story structure, it actually had 13 stories, 4 of which were underground and included several levels of underground parking. According to James Loftus, head of the building's design team, 2/3 of the square footage of the building was underground. Prior to the explosions, the Mira building had comprised 315,000 square feet, which included 107,000 square feet of office space, 196,000 square feet of storage, and 11,750 square feet of what was called special space, including bathrooms and a cafeteria. Originally, the underground parking garage had been built with a 10,000-gallon gasoline reservoir and pump, but fortunately, the reservoir had since been filled with sand. Following the explosions, all that remained of the exterior, above-ground structure were the shattered east, south, and west walls. The north wall, a curtain wall constructed primarily of steel, reinforced concrete, glass, and aluminum, had been blown 50 yards away from the federal building to the north across Northwest 5th Street. There it had crashed into the south side edifice of and left a huge hole several stories tall in the Journal Record building. The flying rubble then became a mangled heap piled along the sidewalk and parking lot. The Journal Record building had been constructed in 1923 by the Masonic Temple Building Association of Oklahoma, Lodge No. 36, and for 14 years its auditorium played host to many illustrious entertainers. The Masons and the India Temple Shrine used the new Masonic Temple as their principal place of business for 7 years until 1930, when both organizations moved to other locations. After the explosions of April 19, 1995, the ornate columns and symbolic temple architecture adorning the east side of the Journal Record building was all that remained unscathed. The rest of the building, inside and out, was a wreck. Many of the properties in the immediate vicinity of the Mira building had originally been owned by the Oklahoma Masonic Lodge No. 36, the India Temple Shrine, the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks, and the Knights of Columbus. These four organizations had, for almost 50 years following the Oklahoma land run of 1889, leased, borrowed, bought, and traded the properties among themselves. Most of those fraternal organizations lost their downtown property holdings during the Great Depression of the 1930s. These properties included land on which would eventually be built the Myriad Convention Center, the Bank First Building, the Wright Building, the Kerr McGee Complex, the Colcord Building, the Internal Revenue Service Office Complex, the Federal Courthouse Building, the Oklahoma Natural Gas Building, the Oklahoma City City Hall, the Manny Building, the YMCA Parking Annex, Liberty Bank Tower, Trigen of Oklahoma, the White Temple, the Journal Record Building, and, of course, the Mira Building. In November 1995, as federal prosecutors were preparing the Oklahoma City bombing case, it was discovered that the Mura building had been built upon a piece of property known as Block 39. Such much mystery still surrounds the property, and as of this writing, the issue has not yet been resolved. It seems that the Mura building itself was owned by the federal government. However, there was no documentation in any of the real estate records which indicated that the government had ever taken possession of the land upon which the building stood. In the absence of that vital possession document, it was ruled that both the federal and local governments had concurrent jurisdiction in the case against the man accused of the bombing, and thus murder charges could be brought against the suspects at every court level. Investigations later revealed that the Masons had bought back the property on which the Journal Record building stood, and they also have bought the land beneath the Mura building. Thus, that organization received a very large portion of the $39 million in government relief and rebuilding funds. Across the street from the Journal Record building, the whole of the Alfred P. Mura Federal Building was severely damaged. But the west end of the building was not as structurally devastated as the east end. The outer measurements of the Mura building were approximately 70 feet deep north to south by 200 feet long east to west. There were only four portions of the interior of the building which did not suffer support column collapse. A section at the west end which measured approximately 70 feet north to south by 40 feet east to west. This was the largest single interior area still standing. B. To the east of this, a middle section of the interior remained, measuring approximately 35 feet north to south by 60 feet east to west. A section of equal size, which comprised the entire north half of the building, had been blown outwardly away from the structure at this location. C. To the east of the middle section, a portion of the building, approximately 60 feet by 60 feet, had been gouged out of the structure, leaving only 10 feet of flooring material still attached to the south wall. And D. The very small southeast corner section remained standing, measuring approximately 50 feet north to south and 20 feet east to west. The interior of the building was completely and totally gutted. As I spoke to Mr. Cooper on the telephone the morning of April 19th, I could hear Oklahoma City Mayor Ron Norick, see Appendix B, on the television reporting to the media that there had been an estimated 590 workers and possibly another 400 citizens conducting morning business in the building at the time of the explosions. We were suddenly faced with the first speculation of the day, that there might have been almost 1,000 people in the Mura building when the explosions occurred. The information being reported was so horrific as to be unbelievable. This sort of event happened in places like Beirut, in Lima, in Bogota, or in New York City, anywhere, anywhere but here. Like everyone else, I felt totally out of my element. This could not have happened in Oklahoma, in my state, in my city. I felt myself hovering near panic. Thousands of possible consequential scenarios were passing through my mind. It seemed to me a foregone conclusion that before the day was over, martial law would be declared. What would that mean in the practical reality of daily living? Having no information yet about possible suspects, but knowing that escalating terrorism and inner-city violence had long been used as a means of manipulating the political will of the American people, the immediate future looked very bleak indeed. I was uncertain as to what plan of action to take in response to the bombing, and that indecisiveness was having a paralyzing effect upon my thinking. Mr. Cooper calmly took matters in hand and brought some focus to the situation. I was instructed to try to find out what was going on. That sounded simple enough, and I thought my husband and I would be able to assemble some kind of a report on the situation before the day was through. I told Bill we would do our best, and I would get back to him late in the afternoon. But as the day progressed, my husband and I discovered that it was going to be a far more complex assignment than we could have ever imagined. As Mr. Cooper and I conversed, my husband reported that former Oklahoma Congressman Dave McCurdy was speaking via telephone to KWTV Channel 9 News anchors Mitch Jelnicker and Jennifer Reynolds. Although the bombing had just occurred, Mr. McCurdy was already certain that Islamic fundamentalists were the parties responsible for the tragedy. McCurdy stated that there was a false sense of security in the heartland, which made it more vulnerable to terrorist attack. He further remarked that a lax security environment existed in places like Oklahoma City and commented that terrorists operate more freely in that environment. Using his position as former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee as his foundation for expertise, McCurdy said he was aware that extreme radical supporters of terrorism in the Middle East had spoken to groups in Oklahoma City and stated that he believed the Islamic fundamentalist involvement was a very real possibility. Having just impugned those of Middle Eastern descent specifically and Muslims generally without any evidence whatsoever of their participation in this disaster, McCurdy further speculated that the bombing could otherwise have been the work of some extreme right-wing militant anti-government group. His reasoning behind this opinion centered on the fact that Wednesday, April 19th, was the second anniversary of the government raid on the Branch Davidian complex in Waco, Texas. Dave McCurdy was not the only official personage offering public speculation and innuendo. U.S. Congresswoman Ileana Ross Leighton from Miami, Florida, told the press that she had notified the FBI of testimony which had occurred before her subcommittee in Washington. She stated that Stephen Emerson, who had produced the PBS documentary entitled Jihad in America, had described witnessing a meeting in Oklahoma City attended by 3,000 Islamic fundamentalists. According to Leighton's press conference, Emerson had testified that a militant Islamic leader based in Pakistan, Kamal Kelbawi, had addressed the group saying, quote, "O brothers, the Palestine cause is not a conflict of borders and land only. It is not even a conflict over human ideology and not over peace. Rather, it is an absolute clash of civilizations between truth and falsehood, between two conducts, one satanic headed by Jews and their conspirators, and the other religious carried by Hamas, the Islamic people in general, and the Islamic movement in particular," end quote. Emerson's PBS special had aired on educational television in November of 1994. This third-hand information, in tandem with Dave McCurdy's second-hand information, was used by the media to fuel anti-Islamic sentiment which would endanger the lives of respectable citizens and would result in at least one death in the Islamic community before the madness changed its direction and fingers were pointed at other suspects in the bombing. A warning light went off in my head as I felt the wheels of the national propaganda machine beginning to roll into motion. It was going to be a day of rumor and speculation, and it would be critical to keep track of what was said, when it was said, by whom, to whom, and to what it was said in response. One thing was certain. The Middle Eastern rumors were originating with the Washington bureaucrats. Later reports of Middle Eastern participants were obtained by the news media from eyewitnesses in the downtown area. However, by that time, the government and federal law enforcement agencies had targeted American patriot groups and then vigorously denied all of the rumors they had previously manipulated. Additionally, some of the witnesses who had seen men of Middle Eastern appearance in the area of the Mura building on the morning of April 19th stated that they had been threatened and harassed by federal law enforcement agents to keep quiet and to say nothing about what they believed they had seen. That persons of Middle Eastern appearance were observed in the area was not surprising. As the evidence began to pile up, it was apparent that these men were deliberately in place and were intended to be seen by the public. It also became clear that they were not acting on the instructions of some Muslim fundamentalist terrorist leader or group but rather were under the direction and control of federal agencies who had planned a sting operation for the night of April 18th, which had gone tragically awry. It was also never established that these men who were meant to be seen were Middle Eastern nationals, but rather were probably American citizens of Middle Eastern descent. Mr. Cooper told me to observe a pattern that would soon emerge. He predicted that Islamic fundamentalists would initially be blamed for the disaster, but within a few days, charges would be leveled against militia groups in the United States. I filed that information into the back of my mind for future reference. It would be only 51 hours until Mr. Cooper's prediction came to pass, and by that time I fully understood how he could so accurately make that prediction. By then, the disinformation campaign was in full swing. By then, the evidence of a major cover-up by federal authorities was obvious and well-documented to anyone who could break through the mass hypnotic hysteria. This hysteria was the result of a saturation attack on the public perpetrated by the national media and directed by the United States Department of Justice. It was going to be difficult, to say nothing of treacherous, to keep footing on firm, logical ground in the face of what occurred over the days which followed. Ladies and gentlemen, copies of this work and of all the evidence and the tapes, audio and video, and sworn affidavits have been distributed to key personnel within the intelligence service across the country. Any attempts to stop the publication of this material or to harm Major Michelle Marie Moore of the Second Continental Army of the Republic will not only be futile, but will be met with the most serious resistance that you can possibly imagine. Good night, and God bless you all.